Chapter 50. Bridgens. River Camp, 29 July, 1848. John Bridgens had always secretly compared the different parts of his life to the various pieces of literature that had formed his life. In his boyhood and student years, he had from time to time thought of himself as different characters from Boccaccio's Decameron or from Chaucer's ribald Canterbury Tales, and not all of his chosen characters were heroic by any means. His attitude toward the world for some years was, "Kiss my ass." In his 20s, John Bridgens most identified with Hamlet. The strangely aging Prince of Denmark, Bridgens was quite sure that the boy Hamlet had magically aged over a few theatrical weeks to a man who was, at the very least, in his 30s by Act 5, had been suspended between thought and deed, between motive and action, frozen by a consciousness so astute and unrelenting that it made him think about everything, even thought itself. The young Bridgens had been a victim of such consciousness, and like Hamlet, had frequently considered that most essential of questions, to continue or not to continue. Bridgens' tutor at the time, an elegant don in exile from Oxford, who was the first unabashed sodomite the young would-be scholar had ever encountered, had disdainfully taught him that the famous "to be or not to be" soliloquy was not in any way a discussion of suicide, but Bridgens knew better. "Thus doth conscience make cowards of us all," had spoken directly to the boy man-soul of John Bridgens. Miserable with the state of his existence and his unnatural desires, miserable when pretending to be something he was not, miserable when pretending and miserable when not pretending, and most centrally, miserable that he could only think about ending his own life, because the fear that thought itself might continue on the other side of this mortal veil, perchance to dream, kept him from acting even toward quick, decisive, cold-blooded self-murder. Luckily, even as a young man not yet become himself, John Bridgens had two things besides indecision that kept him from self-destruction: books and a sense of irony. In his middle years, Bridgens most thought of himself as Odysseus. It was not the wandering the world alone that made the comparison apt for the would-be scholar turned secondary officer's steward, but rather Homer's description of the world-weary traveller, the Greek word meaning crafty or guileful, by which Odysseus' contemporaries identified him, and by which some such as Achilles chose to insult him. Bridgens did not use his craft to manipulate others, or rarely did, but used it more like one of the round leather and wood or prouder metal shields behind which Homeric heroes sheltered while under violent attack by spear and lance. He used his craft to become and to stay invisible. Once, some years ago, during the five-year voyage on the HMS Beagle, during which he had come to know Harry Pegler, Bridgens mentioned his Odysseus analogy, suggesting that all the men on such a trip were modern-day Ulysses, to some extent or another. To the natural philosopher aboard, the two played chess frequently in Mr. Darwin's tiny cabin, and the young bird expert with the sad eyes and sharp mind had looked penetratingly at the steward and said, "But how is it that I doubt you have a Penelope waiting at home, Mr. Bridgens?" The steward had been more circumspect after that. He had learned, as Odysseus had learned after a certain number of years of his wanderings, that his guile was no match for the world, and that hubris would always be punished by the gods. In these last few days, John Bridgens felt that the literary character with whom he had most in common, in outlook, in feeling, in memory, in future, in sadness, was King Lear, and it was time for the final act. They had stayed 2 days at the mouth of the river that drained into the unnamed strait south of King William Land, now known to be King William Island. The river here in late July was running freely in places and allowed them to fill all their water casks, but no one had seen or caught a fish from it. No animals seemed interested in coming down to drink from it, not so much as a white Arctic fox. The best one could say about this campsite was that the slight indentation of the river valley kept them out of the worst of the wind and afforded them some peace of mind during the lightning storms that raged every night. Both mornings at this camp, the men, hopefully, prayerfully laid their tents, sleeping bags, and whatever clothing they could spare out on rocks to dry in the sunlight. There came, of course, no more sunlight. Several times it drizzled. The only day with blue sky they had seen in the past month and a half had been their last day in the boats, and after that day, most of the men had to see Dr. Goodsir for their sunburns. Goodsir, as Bridgens knew well, being his assistant, had very few medicines left in the box he'd put together from the supplies of his three dead colleagues as well as his own. There were still some purgatives in the good doctor's arsenal, mostly castor oil and tincture of jalap, made from morning glory seeds, and some stimulants for the scurvy cases, camphor and hartshorn being the last after the tincture of lobelia had been used so liberally in the first months of scurvy symptoms, some opium as a sedative, a bit of mandragora, and Dover's powders left dull pain, and only sulphate of copper and lead remaining to disinfect wounds or deal with sunburned turned to blisters. Obeying Dr. Goodsir's orders, Bridgens had administered almost all of the sulphate of copper and lead to the moaning men who had stripped their shirts off while rowing, and added severe sunburn to their nightly misery. But there was no sunlight now to dry the tents or clothes or bags. The men stayed wet, and at night they moaned as they shook with cold and burned with fever. Reconnaissance by their healthiest, fastest-walking shipmates had shown that while out of sight of land on boats, they had passed a deeply indented bay less than 15 miles to the northwest of this river, where they had finally put into shore. Most shocking of all, the scouts reported that the entire island curved back to the northeast only 10 miles ahead of them to the east. If this was true, they were very close to the southeast corner of King William Island, their closest possible approach on this landmass to the Back River Inlet. Back River, their destination, lay southeast across the strait, but Captain Crozier had let the men know that he planned to continue man-hauling east on King William Island to the point where the coast of the island ceased its current southeastern slant. There, at this final point of land, they would set up camp again on the highest place possible and watch the strait. If the ice broke in the next 2 weeks, they would take to the boats. If it did not, they would try to haul them south across the ice toward the Adelaide Peninsula, and upon hitting land there, head due east the 15 miles or fewer that Crozier estimated remained before they would reach the inlet leading south to Back's River. The end game had always been the weakest part of John Bridgen's chess skills. He rarely enjoyed it. On the evening before they were scheduled to leave River Camp at dawn, Bridgens neatly packed away his personal gear, including the thick journal he had kept over the past year. He had left 5 longer ones on Terra the previous 22 April, set it in his sleeping bag with a note that anything useful should be shared by his mates, took Harry Pegler's journal and his comb, added an old clothes brush that Bridgens had carried for many years, put them in his peacoat pocket, and went to Dr. Goodsir's small medical tent to say goodbye. "What do you mean you're going for a walk and might not be back by the time we leave tomorrow?" demanded Goodsir. "What kind of talk is that, Bridgens?"
"I'm sorry, Doctor. I just have a strong desire to take a stroll."
"A stroll?" repeated Goodsir. "Why, Mr. Bridgens? You are 30 years older than the average surviving seaman on this expedition, but you are 10 times healthier."
"I've always been lucky when it came to health, sir," said Bridgens. "All due to heredity, I fear. No thanks to any wisdom I may have shown over the years."
"Then why?" began the surgeon.
"It's just time, Dr. Goodsir. I confess to considering trodding the boards as a thespian long ago when I was young. One of the few things I learned about that profession was that the great actors learn how to make a good exit before they wear out their welcome or overplay a scene."
"You sound like a stoic, Mr. Bridgens, a follower of Marcus Aurelius. If the Emperor is displeased with you, you go home, draw a warm bath."
"Oh, no, sir," said Bridgens. "While I admit I've always admired the stoic philosophy, the truth is I've always had a fear of knives and blades. The Emperor would have had my head, my family, and lands for certain. I'm such a coward when it comes to sharp edges. I just wish to take a walk this evening, perhaps a nap."
"Perchance to dream?" said Goodsir.
"Aye, there's the rub," admitted the steward. The rue and anxiety, and perhaps fear in his voice, were real.
"Do Do you really think we have no chance to reach help? Asked the surgeon.
He sounded sincerely curious and only a little sad. Bridgens did not answer for a minute. Finally he said, I truly do not know. Perhaps it all depends upon whether a rescue party has already been sent north from Great Slave Lake or one of the other outposts. I would think they might have. We have been out of touch for 3 years now, and if so, there may be a chance. I do know that if anyone on our expedition could get us home, Captain Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier is that man. He's always been underrated by the Admiralty, is my humble opinion.
Tell him that yourself, man, said good sir. Or at least tell him that you're leaving. You owe him that.
Bridgens smiled.
I would, Doctor. But you and I both know that the captain would not let me go. He is stoic, I think, but no stoic. He might put me in chains to keep me going on.
Yes, agreed good sir. But you'll be doing me a favor if you stay, Bridgens. I have some amputations coming up that will require your steady hand.
There are other young men who can help you, sir, and who have hands far steadier and stronger than mine.
But no one is intelligent, said good sir. No one I can talk to as I have with you. I value your advice.
Thank you, Doctor, said Bridgens. He smiled again. I didn't want to tell you, sir, but I've always been queasy around pain and blood since I was a boy. I very much appreciated the opportunity to work with you these past weeks, but it's gone against my basically squeamish nature. I've always agreed with St. Augustine when he said that the only real sin is human pain. If there are amputations coming, it's best I'm going. He extended his hand. Goodbye, Dr. Goodsir.
Goodbye, Bridgens.
The doctor used both of his hands to shake the older man's.
Bridgens walked northeast out of camp, climbed up out of the shallow river valley. As with everywhere else on King William Island, no hill or ridgeline was much higher than 15 or 20 feet above sea level. Found a rocky ridgeline free of snow and followed it away from camp. Sunset now came sometime around 10 p.m., but John Bridgens had decided that he would not walk until dark. About 3 miles from river camp, he found a dry spot on the ridge, sat, and took a ship's biscuit, his day's ration, from his peacoat pocket and slowly ate it. Completely stale, it was one of the most delicious things he'd ever tasted. He had neglected to bring water with him, but now he scooped up a bit of snow and let it melt in his mouth.
The sunset to the southwest was beautiful. For an instant, the sun actually emerged in the gap between low grey cloud and high grey gravel, hung there as an orange ball for a moment, the kind of sunset that Odysseus, not Lear, would have seen and enjoyed, and then disappeared. The day and air grew grey and mellow, although the temperature that had held in the 20s all day was dropping very quickly now. A wind would come up soon. Bridgens would like to be asleep before the nightly wind howled out of the northwest, or the nightly lightning storms rolled across the land and ice strait. He reached into his pocket and removed the last 3 items there. First was the clothes brush that John Bridgens had used as steward for more than 30 years. He touched the bits of lint on it, smiled at some irony understood only by himself, and set it in his other pocket. Next was Harry Pegler's horn comb. A few light brown hairs still clung to the teeth of it. Bridgens held the comb tightly in his cold, bare fist for a moment, and then set it in his coat pocket with the clothes brush. Last was Pegler's notebook. He flipped it open at random.
O death, where is thy sting? The grave at Comfort Cove, for who has any doubt now? The dire, sad.
Bridgens shook his head. He knew that the last word should be said, whatever else the water-stained, unillegible part of the message should have read. He had taught Pegler to read, but had never succeeded in teaching Harry how to spell. Bridgens suspected, since Harry Pegler was one of the most intelligent human beings he'd ever known, that there had been some problem with the constitution of the man's brain, some lobe or lump or grey area unknown to medical learning that controlled the spelling of words. Even in the years after, he'd learned to decode the alphabet and read the most challenging of books with a scholar's insight and understanding. Harry had been unable to pen the shortest letter to Bridgens without reversing letters and misspelling the simplest words.
Oh, death, where is thy sting?
Bridgens smiled a final time, set the journal in his front jacket pocket where it would be safe from small scavengers because he would be lying on it, and stretched out on his side on the gravel, laying his cheek on the backs of his bare hands. He stirred only once to tug his collar up and his hat down. The wind was coming up, and it was very cold. Then he resumed his napping position. John Bridgens was asleep before the last of the grey twilight died in the south. Chapter 51. Crozier. Rescue Camp, 13 August 1848. They'd hauled for 2 weeks to the southeasternmost tip of the island, the point where the King William Island shoreline abruptly began curving north and east, and then they'd stopped to set up tents, send out hunting parties, and catch their breath while waiting and watching for openings in the sea straight ice to the south. Dr. Goodsir had told Crozier that he needed time to deal with the sick and injured they'd been hauling in their 5 boats. They named the campsite Land's End. When Crozier was informed by Goodsir that at least 5 men needed to have feet amputated during the stop there, which meant, he knew, that those men would never go farther than this place, since even the ambulatory seamen no longer had the strength to haul the extra weight of men in boats, the captain renamed the wind-whipped point Rescue Camp. The idea, so far discussed only between Goodsir and himself, although suggested by Goodsir, was for the surgeon to stay behind with the men recovering from the amputations. 4 had been operated on already, and so far none had died. The last man, Mr. Diggle, was to have his amputation this morning. Other seamen, too sick or weary to continue on, could opt to stay with Goodsir and the amputees, while Crozier, Devoe, Couch, Crozier's trusted second mate Johnson, and any others with strength left would sail south down the inlet when, if, the ice relented again. Then this smaller group, travelling lightly, would head up back river, returning with a rescue party from Great Slave Lake in the spring, or with the help of a miracle in the next month or two before winter arrived, providing that they ran into a rescue party moving north along the river. Crozier knew that the chances of that particular miracle were so low as to be almost nil, and that the chances of any of the sick men surviving at rescue camp until the following spring without help were not even worth discussing. There had been almost no easily hunted game all this summer of 1848, and August was proving to be no different. The ice had been too thick to fish through everywhere except in the few small leads and rare year-round polynyas, and they'd caught no fish, even while in the boats. How could Goodsir and a few other attendants to the dying survive the coming winter here? Crozier knew that the surgeon had voluntarily signed his death warrant by volunteering to stay behind with the doomed men, and Goodsir knew his captain knew it. Neither man spoke of it. Yet that remained the current plan, unless Goodsir changed his mind this morning, or a true miracle occurred, and the ice opened up almost all the way to the shore this second week of August, allowing them all to set sail in 2 battered whaleboats, 2 battered cutters, and a single splintery pinnace, bringing the amputees, the injured, the starved, the 2 weak to walk and the most advanced scurvy cases with them in the boats. As potential food, thought Crozier. This was the next issue that had to be dealt with. The captain carried 2 pistols in his greatcoat whenever he went out of his tent now, his large percussion cap revolver in his right pocket, as always, and the 2-shot twin-barreled little percussion pistol, what the American sea captain who'd sold it to him years ago had called a riverboat gambler's belly gun, in his left pocket. He did not repeat his mistake of sending his best men, Couch, Devoe, Johnson, some others, out of camp at the same time, while leaving such malcontents as Hickey, Aylmore, and the idiot giant Manson behind. Nor had Francis Crozier trusted Lieutenant George Henry Hodgson, his captain of the forecastle, Reuben Mayle, or Erebus captain of the foretop, Robert Sinclair, since that day of near mutiny back at Hospital Camp more than a month earlier. The view from rescue camp was depressing. The sky had been an unrelieved mass of low clouds for 2 weeks, and Crozier hadn't been able to use his sextant. The wind had begun blowing hard from the northwest again, and the air was colder than it had been for 2 months. The strait to the south remained a solid mass of ice, but not the flat ice, interrupted by occasional pressure ridges, such as they'd crossed on the trek from Terra to Terra Camp, so very, very, very long ago. The ice in this strait south of King William Island was a total jumble of full-sized and shattered icebergs, criss-crossing pressure ridges, the occasional year-round Polynya showing black water 10 feet below the ice level but leading nowhere, and countless razor-edged seracs and ice boulders. Crozier didn't believe that any man in rescue camp, including the giant Manson, was up to man-hauling a single boat through that ice forest and over those mountain ranges of ice. The growls, explosions, crackings, blasts, and roars that now filled their days and nights were their only hope. The ice was agitated and torturing itself. Now and then, far out, it opened into tiny leads that sometimes lasted for hours. Then they closed with a thunderclap. Pressure ridges leapt to the height of 30 feet in a matter of seconds. Hours later, they collapsed just as quickly as new ridges thrust themselves up. Icebergs exploded from the pressure of the tightening ice around them. "It is only 13 August, Crozier told himself. The problem with that thinking, of course, was that instead of only 13 August, the season was now far enough along that it was time to be thinking, "It is already 13 August. Winter was fast approaching. Erebus and Terra had been first frozen in place off King William Land in September 1846, and there had been no respite after that. "It is only 13 August, Crozier repeated to himself. Time enough, if only a small miracle was granted them, to sail and row across the strait, probably man-hauling some short ice portages, the 75 miles he estimated to the mouth of Back's River, there to re-rig the battered boats for travel upriver. With a bit more luck, the inlet itself beyond this visible ice jam would be free of ice, because of Back's Great Fish River's inevitable high summer flow northward and its warmer water for as much as 60 miles of the way. After that, on the river itself, they would be racing the oncoming winter south each day while fighting their way upstream, but the voyage was still possible. In theory. In theory. This morning, a Sunday, if the weary Crozier had not lost track, good sir was performing the last of the amputations with the help of his new assistant, Thomas Hartnell, and then Crozier planned to call the men together for a sort of divine service. There he would announce that good sir would be staying with the crippled men and scurvy cases, and he would bring into the open his plans to take a few of the healthiest men and at least 2 boats south within the coming week, whether the ice opened or not. If Reuben Mayle, Hodgson, Sinclair, or the Hickey conspirators wanted to offer their alternate plans without challenging his authority, Crozier was ready not only to discuss them, but to agree to them. The fewer men left at rescue camp, the better, especially if it meant getting rid of the rotten apples. The screaming started from the surgical tent as Dr. Goodsir began his operation on Mr. Diggle's gangrenous left foot and ankle. A pistol in each pocket, Crozier went to find Thomas Johnson to tell him to assemble the men. Mr. Diggle, the most universally liked man on the expedition, and the excellent cook Francis Crozier had known and worked with for years on expeditions to both poles, died of blood loss and complications immediately after the amputation of his foot, and just minutes before muster was called. Each time the survivors spent more than 2 days at a camp, the bosuns dragged a stick through the gravel and snow in some relatively open, flat spot to create the rough outline of the Erebus's and Terra's top and lower decks. This allowed the men to know where to stand during muster and gave them a sense of familiarity. During the first days at Terra Camp and beyond, the muster positions had been crowded to the point of confusion, with more than 100 men from 2 ships crowding into the footprint of a single ship's top deck. But now the attrition had reached the point where the gathering was appropriate for a single ship's mustering. In the silence after the roll was called, and before Crozier's brief reading of scripture, And in the deeper silence in the aftermath of Mr. Diggle's screams, the captain looked out at the clusters of ragged, bearded, pale, filthy, hollow-eyed men leaning forward toward him in a sort of tired ape slump that was meant to be a brisk standing at attention. Of the 13 original officers on HMS Erebus, 9 were dead. Sir John, Commander FitzJames, Lieutenant Graham Gore, Lieutenant H.T.D. LeVicomte, Lieutenant Fairholme, First Mate Sergeant, Second Master Collins, Ice Master Reed, and Chief Surgeon Stanley. The surviving officers consisted of the First and Second Mates, DeVoe and Couch, the Assistant Surgeon, Goodsir, who now joined the muster ranks late, his posture even more slumped than the other men's, his eyes downcast with exhaustion and defeat, and the purser, Charles Hamilton Osmer, who had survived a serious bout of pneumonia, only to be prostrated in his tent now by scurvy. It did not escape Captain Crozier's attention that all of Erebus's commissioned Navy officers were dead, and that the survivors were mere mates or civilians, granted the honorary title of officer for wardroom purposes. Erebus's 3 warrant officers, Engineer John Gregory, Boatswain Thomas Terry, and Carpenter John Weeks, were all dead. Erebus had left Greenland with 21 petty officers, and at today's muster, 15 of them were still alive, although some of them, such as Purser's steward William Fowler, who had never fully recovered from his burns at the Carnival, were little more than mouths to be fed during the march. A muster of Erebus's able seamen on Christmas Day of 1845 would have heard 19 sailors answering the call. 15 of them were still living. Of 7 Royal Marines who'd originally answered the muster call on Erebus, 3 had survived to this day in August of 1848, Corporal Pearson and Privates Hopcraft and Healy, but all were too sick from scurvy even to stand guard or go hunting, much less haul boats. But this morning they stood leaning on their muskets among the other ragged, slumping forms. Of the 2 ship's boys on Erebus's muster, both actually men of 18 when the 2 ships had sailed, both David Young and George Chambers had survived, but Chambers had been so heavily concussed by the thing from the ice during the Carnival that he had been little more than an idiot since that night of fire. Still, he was able to haul when instructed and to eat when told to, and to keep breathing without prompting. So, according to the muster just finished, 39 of Erebus's original complement of 65 souls were still alive as of 13 August 1848. The officers of HMS Terra had fared a bit better than those of Erebus, at least in the sense that 2 naval officers, Captain Crozier and Second Lieutenant Hodgson, had survived. Second Mate Robert Thomas and Mr. E.J. Helpman, Crozier's clerk in charge, and another civilian who served the expedition with officer's rank were the other remaining officers. Not answering muster today were Crozier's Lieutenants Little and Irving, as well as First Mate Hornby, Ice Master Blanky, Second Master McBean, and both his surgeons, Peddy and MacDonald. 4 of Terra's original 11 officers were still alive. Crozier had started the expedition with 3 warrant officers, Engineer James Thompson, Boatswain John Lane, and Master Carpenter Thomas Honey, and all 3 were still living, although the engineer had wasted away to a hollow-eyed skeleton too weak to stand, much less haul. And Mr. Honey not only showed advanced symptoms of scurvy, but had had both feet amputated the night before. Incredibly, as of this assembly, the carpenter was still alive, and even managed to shout, "Present!" from his tent when his name was called at muster. Terra had sailed with 21 petty officers 3 years earlier, and 16 were still alive on this cloudy August morning. Stoker John Torrington, captain of the foretop Harry Pegler, and quartermasters Kenley and Rhodes had been the only casualties in that group until just moments ago when cook John Diggle had joined the ranks of the dead. Where 19 able seamen had once answered Terra's muster, 10 now did. Although 11 had survived, David Lays still lay comatose and unresponsive in Dr. Goodsir's tent. Of HMS Terra's contingent of 6 Royal Marines, none had survived. Private Heather, who had lingered for months with his shattered skull, finally died the day after they had left River Camp, and his body was left on the gravel, without burial or comment. The ship had recorded two boys on its original muster, and now only one, Robert Golding, almost 23 years old and certainly no longer a boy, although gullible in a boy's way, answered to the role. Out of an original muster of 62 souls on HMS Terra, 35 had survived to see this divine service at Rescue Camp on 13 August 1848. 39 Erebuses and 35 Terras remained, for a total muster of 74 men out of the 126 who had sailed from Greenland in the summer of 1845. But four of these had suffered one or both of their feet being amputated in the last 24 hours, and at least another 20 were almost certainly too sick, too injured, too starved, or too bone and soul weary to go on. A third of the expedition had reached their limit. It was time for a reckoning.
"Almighty God,"
intoned Crozier in his exhausted rasp,
"with whom do live the spirits of them that depart hence in the Lord, and with whom the souls of the faithful, after they are delivered from the burden of the flesh, are in joy and felicity. We give thee hearty thanks, for that it hath pleased thee to deliver this our brother John Diggle, age 39, out of the miseries of this sinful world. Beseeching thee that it may please thee of thy gracious goodness, shortly to accomplish the number of thine elect, all of us here, if it pleases thee, and thus to hasten thy kingdom, that we, with all those that are departed in the true faith of thy holy name, may have our perfect consummation and bliss, both in body and soul, in thy eternal and everlasting glory. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen."
"Amen,"
croaked the 62 men still able to stand at muster stations.
"Amen,"
came a few voices from the other 12 lying in tents. Crozier did not dismiss the assembled men.
"Men of HMS Erebus and HMS Terror, members of the John Franklin Discovery Service Expedition, shipmates," he rasped loudly, "today we have to decide which way our paths shall carry us. You all remain, under both the ship's articles and the articles of the Royal Discovery Service, which you signed with your oaths of honour, under my command, and will continue to be so until you are released by me. You have followed Sir John, Captain FitzJames, and me this far, and you have done well. Many of our friends and shipmates have gone home to Christ, but 74 of us have persevered. I am resolved in my heart that every man of you here at Rescue Camp today should survive to see England, home, and your families again. And God shall be my witness that I have done my best to make sure that this shall be the outcome of our efforts. But today, I release you to decide your own path by which to reach that goal."
The men murmured to one another. Crozier let that go on for a few seconds and then continued.
"You've heard what we are doing. Dr. Goodsir, to remain here with those too ill to travel. The healthier men to continue towards Bax River. Are there any among you who still wish to attempt to find some other way to rescue?"
There was a silence as men looked down and scuffled their booted feet on the gravel. But then George Hodgson hobbled forward.
"Sir, some of us do, sir.
Want to head back, that is, Captain Crozier. The captain just looked at the young officer for a long moment. He knew that Hodgson was a stalking horse for Hickey, Aylmore, and a few of the more rebellious sea lawyers who had been stirring up the men with resentment for so many months. But he wondered if young Hodgson knew it.
Back to where, Lieutenant?
Crozier asked at last.
To the ship, sir.
Do you think Terror is still there, Lieutenant?
As if to punctuate his query, the sea ice south of them exploded in a series of shotgun blasts and earthquake rumbles. An iceberg hundreds of yards from shore crumbled and fell. Hodgson shrugged like a boy.
Terror camp will be, Captain, whether the ship still is or not. We left food and coal and boats at Terror camp.
Aye, said Crozier. So we did. And we'd all welcome some of that food now. Even some of the tinned food that killed some of us so terribly. But, Lieutenant, that was some 80 or 90 miles, and almost 100 days ago when we left Terror camp. Do you and the others really think you can walk or haul your way back there into the teeth of winter? It would be late November by the time you made your way even to camp. Total darkness. And you remember the temperatures and storms of last November?
Hodgson nodded and said nothing.
We ain't going to walk till no late November,
said Cornelius Hickey, stepping out of the ranks to stand next to the slumped young lieutenant.
We think the ice is open along the shore, back the way we come. We'll sail and row around that fucking cape we hauled 5 boats over like Egyptian slaves and be home in Terror camp in a month.
The assembled men murmured furtively among themselves. Crozier nodded.
It may indeed open for you, Mr. Hickey. Or it may not. But even if it does, it's more than 100 miles back to a ship that may well be crushed, and most certainly will be frozen fast by the time you get there. It's at least 30 miles closer to the mouth of Back River from here, and the odds of the inlet being free of south of here near the river are much greater.
You ain't talking us out of this, Captain, Hickey said firmly. We talked it over amongst ourselves, and we're going.
Crozier stared at the Calker's mate. The captain's usual instinct to put down any insubordination immediately and with great strength and decisiveness rose in him. But he reminded himself that this was what he wanted. It was past time to get rid of the malcontents and to save those others who trusted his judgment. Besides, this late in the summer and in their escape attempt, Hickey's plan might even be workable. It all depended upon where the ice broke up, if it broke up anywhere before the winter set in. The men deserved to choose their own last, best chance.
How many are going with you, Lieutenant?
Asked Crozier, speaking to Hodgson, as if he would actually be the commander of the group.
Well,
began the young man.
Magnus is going, said Hickey, gesturing the giant forward. And Mr. Aylmore?
The sullen gunroom steward swaggered forward, his face filled with defiant and visible contempt toward Crozier.
And George Thompson?
Continued the Calker's mate. Crozier was not surprised that Thompson would be part of Hickey's cabal. The seaman had always been insolent and lazy, and, as long as the rum lasted, drunk whenever possible.
I'm going along too, sir,
said John Morfan, stepping up with the others. William Oren, just turned 26, stepped forward without a word and stood with Hickey's group. Then James Brown and Francis Dunn, Erebus's Calker and Calker's mate, joined the group.
We think it's our best chance, Captain,
said Dunn, and looked down. Waiting for Reuben Mayle and Robert Sinclair to declare their intentions.
realizing that if the majority of men standing at muster joined this group, that all of his own plans for flight south were gone for good. Crozier was surprised when William Gibson, Terror's subordinate officer's steward, and stoker Luke Smith walked slowly forward. They'd been good men aboard ship and stalwart haulers. Charles Best, a reliable Erebus seaman who had always been loyal to Lieutenant Gore, stepped forward with four other seamen in tow. William Jerry, Thomas Work, who had been sorely injured at Carnival, young John Strickland, and Abraham Seeley. The 16 men stood there.
"Is that it, then?" asked Crozier,
feeling a hollow sense of relief that gnawed at his belly like the hunger that was always with him now. 16 men were standing there. They would need one boat, but they were leaving behind enough loyal men to head for Back River with him, while also leaving enough to take care of the ill here at rescue camp.
"I'll give you the pinnace," he said to Hodgson.
The lieutenant nodded gratefully.
"The pinnace is all busted up and rigged for river work, and the sledge is a pain in the arse to drag," said Hickey. "We'll take a whaleboat."
"You'll get the pinnace," said Crozier.
"We want George Chambers and Davy Lays too," said the caulker's mate,
folding his arms and standing legs apart in front of his men, like a Cockney Napoleon.
"The hell you say," said Crozier. "Why would you want to bring two men who can't take care of themselves?"
"George can haul," said Hickey, "and we've been taking care of Davy and want to keep doing so." "No,"
said Dr. Goodsir, stepping forward into the tense space between Crozier and Hickey's men.
"You haven't been taking care of Mr. Lays, and you don't want George Chambers and him as fellow travellers. You want them as food."
Lieutenant Hodgson blinked in disbelief, but Hickey balled up his fists and gestured to Magnus Manson. The little man and huge man took a step forward.
"Stop exactly where you are,"
bellowed Crozier. Behind him, the three surviving Marines, Corporal Pearson, Private Hopcraft, and Private Healy, while visibly ill and shaky on their feet, had lifted and aimed their long muskets. More to the point, First Mate DeVoe, Mate Edward Couch, Bosun John Lane, and Bosun's Mate Tom Johnson were aiming shotguns. Cornelius Hickey actually snarled.
"We got guns too?"
"No," said Captain Crozier, "you do not. While you were at muster, First Mate DeVoe rounded up all weapons. If you leave peaceably tomorrow, you'll get one shotgun and some cartridges. If you take another step right now, you'll all get birdshot in your faces."
"You are all going to die," said Cornelius Hickey, pointing his bony finger at the men standing silently in muster formations while swinging his arm in a half circle like a scrawny weather vane. "You're going to follow Crozier and these other fools, and you're going to die."
The caulker's mate wheeled toward the surgeon.
"Dr. Goodsir, we forgive you for what you said about why we want to save George Chambers and Davy Lays. Come with us. You can't save these men here."
Hickey gestured contemptuously toward the sagging wet tents where the sick men lay.
"They're dead already and just don't know it,"
continued Hickey, his voice very large and loud coming from such a small frame.
"We're going to live. Come with us and see your family again, Dr. Goodsir. If you stay here, or even follow Crozier, you're a dead man. Come with us."
Goodsir had absent-mindedly worn his spectacles when he'd come out from the surgical tent, and now he removed them and unhurriedly wiped moisture from them, using the bloody end of his woolen waistcoat as a rag. A small man with a boy's full lips and a receding chin only partially concealed under the hedge of curly beard that had grown down from his earlier unsuccessful side whiskers, Goodsir seemed completely at ease. He put his spectacles back on
and looked at Hickey and the men behind him.
Mr. Hickey, he said softly, as grateful as I am for your boundless generosity in offering to save my life, you need to know that you do not need me along to do what you are planning to do with regards to dissecting the bodies of your shipmates in order to provide yourself with a larder of meat.
I ain't,
began Hickey. Even an amateur can learn dissective anatomy quite quickly, interrupted good sir, his voice strong enough to override the caulker's mates.
When one of these other gentlemen you're bringing along as your private food stock dies, or when you help him die, all you have to do is sharpen a ship's knife to a scalpel's edge and begin cutting.
We ain't going to, shouted Hickey.
But I do strongly recommend that you bring a saw, overrode good sir. One of Mr. Honey's carpenter saws will do nicely. While you can slice off your shipmate's calves and fingers and thighs and belly flesh with a knife, you shall almost certainly require a good saw to get the legs and arms off.
God damn you!
Screamed Hickey. He started forward with Manson, but stopped when the mates and marines raised their shotguns and muskets again. Unperturbed, not even looking at Hickey, the surgeon pointed toward the huge form of Magnus Manson as if the man were an anatomist's chart hanging on a wall.
It's not so different than carving a Christmas goose when one gets right down to it.
He slashed vertical marks in the air toward Manson's upper torso and a horizontal one just below his waist.
Saw the arms off at the shoulder joints, of course, but you shall have to saw through each man's pelvic bones to cut off his legs.
Hickey's neck cords strained, and his pale face grew red, but he did not speak again while good sir continued.
I would use my smaller metacarpal saw to cut through the legs at the knees, and, of course, the arms at the elbow, and then proceed with a good scalpel to slice away the choice parts. Thighs, buttocks, biceps, triceps, deltoids, the meaty part behind the shins. Only then do you start the real butchering of the pectorals, chest muscles, and to get at any fat you gentlemen may have retained near your shoulder blades or along your sides and lower back. There shan't be much fat there, of course, nor muscle, but I'm sure Mr. Hickey wants no parts of you to go to waste.
One of the seamen in the back of the group behind Crozier dropped to his knees and began to dry retch into the gravel.
I have an instrument called a tenaculum to crack the sternum and to remove the ribs,
good sir said softly,
but I'm afraid I can't let you borrow it. A good ship's hammer and chisel, there's one in every boat kit, you've noticed, should serve that purpose almost as well. I do recommend you attend to rending the flesh first and set aside your friend's heads, hands, feet, intestines, all of the contents of the soft abdominal sac for later. I warn you, it's more difficult than you think to crack open the long bones for their marrow. You'll need some sort of scraping tool, rather like Mr. Honey's wood carving gouge. And do note that the marrow will be lumpy and red when it's forced from the center of the bones, and mixed with bone chips and fragments, so not terribly healthy to eat raw. I recommend you put each other's bone marrow into a pot for cooking straight away and let yourself simmer before trying to digest your friends.
Fuck you!
Snarled Cornelius Hickey. Dr. Goodsir nodded.
Oh,
the surgeon added softly.
When you get around to eating one another's brains, it will be simplicity itself. Simply saw off the lower jaw, throw it away with the lower teeth, and use any knife or spoon to gouge and hack your way up through the soft palate into the cranial vault. If you wish, you may invert the skull and sit around it, scooping out each other's brains like so much Christmas pudding.
For a minute, there were no voices raised, only the wind and the groan, crack, and snapping of the ice.
Is there anyone else who wants to leave tomorrow? Called Captain Crozier.
Reuben Mayle, Robert Sinclair and Samuel Honey, Terra's forecastle captain, Erebus's foretop captain, and Terra's blacksmith, respectively, stepped forward.
"You're going with Hickey and Hodgson?" asked Crozier.
He did not allow himself to show the shock he felt.
"Nay, sir," said Reuben Mayle, shaking his head. "We ain't with them, but we want to try walking back to Terra."
"No boat needed, sir," said Sinclair. "We're going to try hiking cross-country, as it were, straight across the island. Maybe we'll find some foxes and such inland, away from the coast."
"Navigation will be difficult," said Crozier. "Compasses aren't worth a damn here, and I can't give you one of my sextants."
Mayle shook his head.
"No worries, Captain. We'll just use dead reckoning. Most of the time, if the fucking wind is in our face, pardon my language, sir, then we're headed the right way."
"I was a seaman before I was a smith, sir," said Samuel Honey. "We're all sailors. If we can't die at sea, at least this way perhaps we can die aboard our ship."
"All right," said Crozier,
speaking to all the men still standing there and making sure that his voice would reach to the tents.
"We're going to assemble at six bells and divide up all the remaining ship's biscuits, spirits, tobacco, and any other victuals we still have. Every man, even those who had their surgeries last night and today, will be brought to the dividing up. Everyone will see what we have, and every man will get an equal share. From this point on, each man, except those being fed and cared for by Dr. Goodsir, will be in charge of his own rationing."
Crozier looked coldly at Hickey, Hodgson, and their group.
"You men will, under Mr. DeVoe's oversight, go ready your pinnace for your departure. You'll leave at dawn tomorrow, and except for the divvying up of goods and food at six bells, I don't want to see your faces before then."
Chapter 52. Good Sir. Rescue Camp, 15 August 1848. For the 2 days after the amputations and Mr. Diggle's death, and the muster of the men and the hearing of Mr. Hickey's plans, and the pathetic dividing up of the food, the surgeon had no stomach for keeping his diary. He tossed the stained leather book into his travelling medical kit and left it there. The great dividing up, as good sir already thought of it, had been a sad and seemingly endless affair, extending into the shortening August Arctic evening. It soon became obvious that, at least when it came to food, no one trusted anyone. Everyone seemed to harbour some bone-deep anxiety that someone else was hiding food, hoarding food, secreting away food, denying everyone else food. It had taken hours to unpack all boats, empty all stores, search all tents, go through Mr. Diggle's and Mr. Wall's stores, with representatives of each class of man on the ship, officers, warrant officers, petty officers, able seamen, sharing the search and distribution chores, while the other men looked on with avid eyes. Thomas Honey died during the night after the dividing up. Good Sir had Thomas Hartnell inform the captain, and then he helped sew the carpenter's body into his sleeping bag. Two sailors carried it to a snowdrift about 100 yards from the camp, where Mr. Diggle's body already lay in cold state. The troop had begun foregoing burials and burial services, not because of an edict from the captain or some vote, but simply through silent consensus.
"Are we preserving the bodies in the snowdrift so they won't spoil as future food?"
wondered the surgeon. He could not answer his own question. All he knew was that while he was giving Hickey and all the other assembled men, quite deliberately since he had spoken to Captain Crozier about the tactic before the muster assembly, the anatomical details of carving up the human body to serve as sustenance, Harry D. S. Goodsir had been horrified to find himself salivating. And he knew that he could not have been alone in that reaction to the thought of fresh meat.
from whatever source. Only a handful of men had turned out at dawn the next morning, Monday, 14 August, to watch Hickey and his 15 companions leave camp, with their pinnace lashed onto its battered sledge. Good Sir had come back to see them off, after making sure that Mr. Honey had been secretly buried in the drift. Earlier, he had missed seeing the three walking men off. Mr. Mail, Mr. Sinclair, and Samuel Honey, no relation to the recently deceased carpenter, had left before dawn on their proposed trek across the island to Terror Camp, carrying with them only their rucksacks, blanket sleeping bags, some ship's biscuits, water, and one shotgun with cartridges. They had not so much as a single Holland tent for shelter, and planned to build caves in the snow if serious winter weather reached them before they reached Terror Camp. Good Sir thought that they must have said their goodbyes to friends the night before, since the three men were out of camp before the first grey light touched the southern horizon. Mr. Couch later told Good Sir that the party headed north, inland and directly away from the coast, and planned to turn toward the northwest on their second or third day. In contrast, the surgeon was amazed by how heavily Hickey's departing men had loaded their boat. Men all over camp, including Mail, Sinclair, and Samuel Honey, had been abandoning useless items: hairbrushes, books, towels, writing desks, combs, bits of civilization they'd hauled for 100 days, and now refused to haul any farther. And for some inexplicable reason, Hickey and his men had loaded many of these rejected pieces of junk into their pinnace, along with tents, sleeping gear, and necessary food. One bag held 105 individually wrapped chunks of dark chocolate that was the shared accumulation of these 16 men's allotment of a secret store, hauled all this way as a surprise by Mr. Diggle and Mr. Wall. 6.5 pieces of chocolate per man. Lieutenant Hodgson had shaken hands with Crozier, and a few of the other men had said clumsy farewells to old shipmates. But Hickey, Manson, Aylmore, and the most resentful of the group said nothing. Then Bosun's mate Johnson gave Hodgson the unloaded shotgun and a bag of cartridges, and watched while the young lieutenant stowed them in the heavily loaded boat. With Manson in the lead, and at least a dozen of the 16 men lashed to the sledge and longboat by harnesses, they left the camp in silence, broken only by the scrape of runners on gravel, then on snow, then on rock again, then again across ice and snow. Within 20 minutes, they were out of sight over the slight rise to the west of Rescue Camp.
"Are you thinking about whether they'll make it, Dr. Good Sir?"
asked Mate Edward Couch, who had been standing next to the surgeon and observing his silence.
"No,"
said Good Sir. He was so weary that he could only answer honestly.
"I was thinking about Private Heather."
"Private Heather?"
said Couch.
"Why, we left his body."
He stopped.
"Yes,"
said Good Sir.
"The Marine's corpse is lying under a shred of canvas by the side of our sledge tracks this side of River Camp, not 12 days' pull west of here. Much less time than that at the rate Hickey's large team is pulling the single pinnace."
"Oh, Jesus Christ,"
hissed Couch. Good Sir nodded.
"I just hope they do not find the subordinate officer's steward's body. I liked John Bridgens. He was a dignified man, and deserves better than to be devoured by the likes of Cornelius Hickey."
That afternoon, Good Sir was directed to come to a meeting near the four boats along the shore. The two whaleboats were inverted, as always, the cutters still upright on their sledges but unloaded, out of the hearing of the men at their duties or drowsing in their tents. Captain Crozier was there, as were First Mate Devoe, First Mate Robert Thomas, Acting Mate Couch, Bosun's Mate Johnson, Bosun John Lane, and Marine Corporal Pearson, who was too weak to stand and had to half recline against the splintered hull of an overturned whaleboat.
"Thank you for coming so promptly, Doctor,"
said Crozier,
We're here to discuss ways to guard against the return of Cornelius Hickey's group and to look at our own options over the coming weeks.
Surely, Captain, said the surgeon. You don't expect Hickey, Hodgson, and the others to come back here.
Crozier held up his gloved hands and shrugged. Light snow whipped around and between the men.
You might still want David Lays, or the corpses of Mr. Diggle and Mr. Honey, or even you, Doctor.
Good Sir shook his head and shared his thoughts about the bodies, starting with Private Heather that lay along the return way to Terror Camp, like frozen food cachets.
Aye, said Charles Devoe. We've thought of that. It's probably the main reason that Hickey thought he could get back to Terra.
But we're still going to mount a round-the-clock watch here at Rescue Camp for a few days and send Bosun's Mate Johnson here out with a man or two to follow Hickey's group for 3 or 4 days, just to be sure.
As for our future here, Dr. Goodsir, rasped Crozier, what do you see?
It was the surgeon's turn to shrug.
Mr. Jobson, Mr. Helpman, and Engineer Thompson will not live more than a few days, he said softly. Of my other 15 or so scurvy patients, I simply do not know. A few might survive, the scurvy, I mean, especially if we find fresh meat for them. But of the 18 men who may stay here at rescue camp with me, Thomas Hartnell has volunteered to stay on as my assistant, by the way. Only 3, perhaps 4, will be capable of going out to hunt seals on the ice or foxes inland, and they not for long. I would presume that the rest of those who remain here will have died of starvation no later than 15 September. Most of us, sooner than that.
He left unstated that some might survive a while longer here by eating the bodies of the dead. He also did not mention that he, Dr. Harry D. S. Goodsir, had decided that he would not turn cannibal to survive, nor help those who found need to. His dissection instructions at the previous day's muster assembly were his last words on the subject. Yet he would also never cast judgment on the men here at rescue camp, or on the expedition south who did end up eating human flesh to last a short while longer. If any man on the Franklin expedition understood that the human body was a mere animal vessel for the soul, and only so much meat once that soul had departed, it was their surviving surgeon and anatomist, Dr. Harry Goodsir. Not extending his own life a few weeks or even months longer by partaking of such dead flesh was his own decision, for his own moral and philosophical reasons. He had never been an especially good Christian, but he preferred to die as one nonetheless.
We may have an alternative, Rosie said softly,
almost as if reading Goodsir's thoughts.
I've decided this morning that the Bax River party can stay here at rescue camp another week, perhaps 10 days, depending upon the weather, in hopes that the ice will break up and that we can all depart here on boats, even the dying.
Goodsir frowned dubiously at the 4 boats around them.
Can so many of us fit in these few craft? He asked.
Don't forget, Doctor, said Edward Couch. There are 19 fewer of us now after the malcontents' departure this morning, and 2 more dead since yesterday morn. That's only 53 souls for 4 good boats, ourselves included.
And as you say, said Thomas Johnson, more will die in the coming week.
And we have almost no food to haul now, said Corporal Pearson, from where he sprawled against the inverted whaleboat. I wish to God it was otherwise.
And I've decided to leave all the tents behind, said Crozier.
Where will we shelter in a storm? Asked Goodsir.
Under the boats on the ice, said Devoe. Under the boat covers on open water. I did it during my attempt to reach the Boothia Peninsula last March in the middle of winter, and it's warmer under or in a boat than in those fucking tents. Excuse my language, Captain.
You're excused, said Crozier. Also, the Holland tents each weigh 3 or 4 times what they did when we started this voyage. They never dry out. They must have soaked up half the moisture in the Arctic.
So has our underlinens,
said Mate Robert Thomas. Everyone laughed to one extent or another. Two of them ended the laughter with coughs.
I'm also planning to leave all but three of the big water casks behind, said Crozier. Two of them will be empty when we set out. Each boat will have only one of the small casks for storage.
Good sir shook his head.
How will your men slake their thirst while you're in the strait waters or on the ice there?
Our thirst, doctor, said the captain. If the ice opens, remember that you and the sick men will be coming along, not staying here to die. And we'll refill the casks regularly when we get to the fresh water of Back's River. Until then, I have a confession. We, the officers, did hoard one thing we did not confess to yesterday at the dividing up. A bit of spirit stove fuel hidden under the false bottom of one of the last rum casks.
We'll melt ice and snow for drinking water on the ice, said Johnson.
Good sir nodded slowly. He had been so reconciled to the certainty of his own death in the coming days or weeks that even the thought of potential salvation was almost painful. He resisted the urge to allow his hopes to rise again. Odds were overwhelming that everyone, Hickey's group, Mr. Mayle's three adventurers, Crozier's south rowing group, would be dead in the coming month. Again, as if reading his thoughts, Crozier said to good sir,
What will it take, doctor, to give us a chance to survive the scurvy and weakness for the 3 months it may take us to row up river to Great Slave Lake?
Fresh food,
the surgeon said simply.
I'm convinced that we can beat back the disease in some of the men if we can get fresh food. If not vegetables and fruits, which I know are impossible up here, then fresh meat, especially fat. Even animal blood will help.
Why will meat and blubber arrest or cure such a terrible disease, doctor? Asked Corporal Pearson.
I have no idea, said good sir, shaking his head. But I am as certain of it as I am that we will all die of scurvy if we do not get fresh meat, even before starvation will kill us.
If Hickey or the others reach Terror Camp, said DeVoe, will the tinned Goldner food serve the same purpose?
Good sir shrugged again.
Possibly, although I agree with my late colleague, Assistant Surgeon MacDonald, that fresh food is always better than canned. Also, I am convinced that there were at least two types of poison in the Goldner tins, one slow and nefarious, the other, as you remember with poor Captain FitzJames and some others, very quick and terrible. Either way, we're better off seeking and finding fresh meat or fish than they are pinning their hopes on aging tins from the Goldner victuallers.
We hope, said Captain Crozier, that once out on the open water of the inlet, amidst the free floating flows, seals and walruses will be available in plentitude before the real winter sets in. Once on the river, we'll put in from time to time to hunt deer, foxes, or caribou, but may have to pin our hopes on catching fish. A real probability, according to such explorers as George Back and our own Sir John Franklin.
Sir John also ate his shoes, said Corporal Pearson.
No one reprimanded the starving marine, but neither did anyone laugh or respond until Crozier said, his rasping voice sounding totally serious,
That's the real reason I brought along hundreds of extra boots, not just to keep the men's feet dry, which, as you have seen, Doctor, was an impossibility, but to have all that leather to eat during the penultimate portion of our trek south.
Good sir could only stare.
We'll have only one cask of water, but hundreds of Royal Navy-issued boots to eat.
Yes, said Crozier.
Suddenly all eight men began laughing so hard that they could not stop. When the others ceased, someone would begin laughing again, and then everyone would join in.
Shh,
Crozier said at last, sounding like a schoolmaster with boys, but still chuckling himself. Men at their duties in the camp 20 yards away were looking over with curiosity,
painted on their pale faces, staring out from under Welsh wigs and caps. Good sir had to wipe away tears and snot before they froze to his face.
We're not going to wait for the ice to open all the way up to the shore here,
Crozier said into the sudden silence in the group.
Tomorrow, as Bosun's mate Johnson secretly follows Hickey's group northwest along the coast, Mr. DeVoe will take a group of our ablest men south across the ice, moving with just rucksacks and sleeping blankets. With luck, travelling almost as quickly as Reuben Mayle and his two friends, going at least 10 miles out onto the strait, perhaps farther, to see if there is any open water. If a lead opens to within 5 miles of this camp, we are all leaving.
The men have no strength,
began good sir.
They will if they know for certain that there's only a day or two's haul between them and open water all the way to rescue,
said Captain Crozier.
The two surviving men who've had their feet amputated will be on their bloody stumps and pulling with a will if we know the water is out there waiting for us.
And with only a little luck, said Devo, my group will bring back some seals and walruses and blubber. Good sir looked out at the cracking, shifting, pressure ridge surging ice jumble, stretching south below low grey snow clouds.
Can you haul seals and walruses back across that white nightmare? He asked.
Devo just grinned broadly in answer.
We have one thing to be thankful for, said Bosun's mate Johnson. What's that, Tom?
Asked Crozier.
Our friend from the ice seems to have lost interest in us and wandered away, said the still muscular bosun. We've not seen or heard him for certain since before river camp.
All 8 men, including Johnson, suddenly reached over to one of the nearby boats and rapped their knuckles on the wood.